Hey guys, Matt here. Before we begin this episode of Anthology, I just want to mention that we are currently running a contest where you can win a free Anthology t-shirt. The contest runns from now until January 1st, 2018. If you want to enter, all you have to do is leave a rating and review of the podcast on iTunes or on Stitcher, take a screenshot of the review, and email it to matt@obsessiveviewer.com with the subject line Anthology t-shirt contest. On January 1st, I'll randomly select a winner from the entries, and we'll get a free t-shirt mailed to them. We'll be accepting entries until December 31st at midnight, so make sure you get the email in before then. Thank you guys for listening, and enjoy this episode of Anthology.
You're traveling through another podcast. A podcast not only of reviewing and discussing, but of discovery. A journey into a wondrous show whose boundaries are that of imagination. That's the RSS feed up ahead. Your next stop, Anthology.
Hello and welcome to Anthology, presented by ObsessiveViewer.com. I'm your host, Matt Hurt, and Anthology is my examination of The Twilight Zone as a first-time viewer. Each podcast, I review one episode of Rod Serling's iconic series and round out the show with a bonus review of a movie or show related to the week's main topic. I also cover modern anthology science fiction shows such as Black Mirror, Hulu's Dimension 404, and the upcoming Philip K. Dick's Electric Dreams in bonus episode review series. You can find more of Anthology as well as a full episode archive at anthologypod.com. And if you want to contact me, you can use the Facebook page at facebook.com/anthologypod. You can tweet me at ovanthologypod or send me an email at matt@obsessiveviewer.com. Today on the podcast, I'll be discussing The Night of the Meek. It is the 11th episode of The Twilight Zone's second season, and it originally aired on December 23rd, 1960. And for this week's bonus review, I'll share my thoughts on Night of the Meek's 1985 counterpart that aired on December 20th, 1985. And I'm very excited about this because I did not plan it this way, that I would be releasing the review of the one episode of The Twilight Zone that is officially a Christmas episode, from my understanding, that I would be reviewing that the week of Christmas. That was just a happy coincidence, and I'm super delighted that I get to do that. But before I get into my review, I have a couple of pieces of news and feedback also. Kevin, a longtime listener, Kevin, has posted on the Facebook page, and he said, I was watching The Twilight Zone the other night, and I was probably just as excited as you were when I realized you'd be able to do The Night of the Meek in time for Christmas. If you're looking for another bonus review you could do during the holidays, I'd recommend Carol for Another Christmas, a special TV movie written by Rod Serling and directed by Joseph L. Mankiewicz as a modern take on A Christmas Carol meant to publicize the UN. The cast includes Sterling Hayden, Ava Marie Saint, Peter Sellers, Ben Gazzara, Robert Shaw, and Britt Eklund. Yes, so first of all, thank you, Kevin, for recommending that, and that's something that I'm going to definitely keep in mind around this time next year when I'm looking at what my bonus review will be around Christmas. The one stipulation of that is that I did some digging. There isn't a good copy of Carol for Another Christmas on YouTube. There's like a really distorted audio version. I don't know if that was just a poor export or if that was to kind of dodge YouTube's copyright stuff. But and then it's not really available anywhere digitally. There is a DVD available that's on Amazon that you can buy, but I'm a little hesitant about that just because the reviews say that the audio gets out of sync about halfway through the movie. So fortunately I have a year to track it down and figure it out. So hopefully by that time, you know, something will a better option will present itself. And then my other piece of news is actually very appropriate for this episode because it's nearing Christmas. I'm going to be releasing this on Monday. I'm going to be releasing this 1 week before Christmas. And, you know, if you are – well, I won't preface it that way. I bought two books, two Twilight Zone related books. The first one I bought, well, I bought both of them, but the first one I want to bring up is The Twilight Zone Encyclopedia by Stephen J. Rubin. It is a very nice and very well put together encyclopedia all about the Twilight Zone. It's basically in the format of an encyclopedia, so you just go to, you know, what you want. It's all alphabetized and everything. It's a really great resource, and it's going to be a very great resource for my growing library of resources for this podcast. And it's a really great, a really well put together book, and I am super excited to dig into it. And also, if you want to hear a review, or not a review, but an interview about the book, you can check out fellow Twilight Zone podcaster Craig Beam interviewed Stephen J. Rubin on his podcast, Between Light and Shadow. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes of this episode. And just, I'm really excited about this, having just an extra resource, because I have the Twilight Zone Companion, I have Martin Graham Jr.'s book, Unlocking the Door to a Television Classic, and what I've come to realize in the last, like, two and a half years, however long I've been doing this, you can never have enough Twilight Zone materials to pour over, because it's a very dense show, and it's got so much to be discussed and so much to be revealed about it, essentially. So that's the Twilight Zone Encyclopedia. I'll also put a link to the Amazon page for it in the show notes, and that should be an associate link. So if you buy the books through that link, I'll get a little bit of money from it. So, you know, it's the holiday season. if you're like, these make great gifts for, you know, people that are fans of the Twilight Zone, or just discovering the Twilight Zone. Although, can I really even say that I'm still just discovering the Twilight Zone, since I'm pretty much at this point almost halfway through season two, and I've watched each one of those episodes several times. But anyway, the second book that I bought is Everything I Need to Know I Learned in the Twilight Zone by Mark Dawitziak. I'm so sorry if I'm mispronouncing that last name, but it's that's my pronunciation of it. Everything I Need to Know I Learned in the Twilight Zone is shaping up to be a really awesome read. I've been kind of thumbing through it. It's essentially a collection of essays that are essentially life lessons, and each one is about the theme or lesson of an episode, or more often than not, a group of episodes. And each essay also includes a mini essay or interview excerpt from very notable people. Just going through it, I saw that there were many like essays and blurbs from Neil deGrasse Tyson, Mick Garris, Mel Brooks, Mark Zakri, who wrote The Twilight Zone Companion, Martin Graham Jr., who wrote Unlocking the Door to a Television Classic, also Jack Klugman, Ray Bradbury, Chris Carter, who created the X-Files, Robert Redford, Greg Nicotero, and David Chase, who created the Sopranos. And all those names I just mentioned are just from thumbing through the book. Like, those are just the ones that I saw in passing as I was kind of going through the book. So this is packed with a lot of stuff, and it's shaping up to be a really, really good read. So that's Everything I Need to Know I Learned in the Twilight Zone, and also link to that in the show notes as well. So I just want to say that. I just wanted to bring that up because I kind of splurged on those two books. And yeah, if you're a fan of The Twilight Zone, definitely pick those up because they are great, great resources. So we are at the Night of the Meek, which is, as I said, the 11th episode of the second season of The Twilight Zone, and it originally aired on December 23rd, 1960. And in honor of the aforementioned books that I purchased, in lieu of the full plot summary from Unlocking the Door to a Television Classic or The Twilight Zone Companion, I'm actually going to read the summary from The Twilight Zone Encyclopedia by Stephen J. Rubin. And it's not a full-on recap of it, but it is a good plot summary. So I'm going to go ahead and read that. And then after that, we are spoilers free. So I'm going to spoil the entire episode of The Night of the Meek. So if you haven't watched it yet, go check it out and come back and listen. Soulful Henry Corwin, a department store Santa, loves the spirit of Christmas and dreams of dispensing real gifts to the less fortunate. But he's a heavy drinker, and his drunkenness gets him fired by the less-than-sympathetic store manager, Mr. Dundee. Wandering the streets, Henry stumbles across what appears to be a large garbage bag, but is actually the answer to a prayer, or many prayers, an all-but-bottomless cornucopia of presents perfectly magically tailored to Henry's friends at the homeless shelter. Henry grabs the bag and becomes a Christmas hero to his homeless friends and the neighborhood children. Okay, so that is a more detailed plot synopsis than I expected. It doesn't go into, you know, the nitty-gritty details of the episode. So I'll get into that in a moment. But again, check out the Twilight Zone Encyclopedia by Stephen J. Rubin, and also Everything I Need to Know I Learned in the Twilight Zone by Mark Dowidziak. And starring in The Night of the Meek is Art Carney as Henry Corwin. This was his only episode of The Twilight Zone, but he also collaborated with Serling on a Playhouse 90 episode titled The Velvet Alley, which I believe was about a down-on-his-luck writer. And Art Carney also appeared in an episode of The Danny Kaye Show with Serling in 1964. And I'm kind of delighted with these next two points about Art Carney's filmography, but because of the season in which we are in, he also appeared in the Star Wars Holiday Special, and he also went on to appear as Santa Claus in a 1984 TV movie titled The Night They Saved Christmas. But he's perhaps best known, I think, for his role as Ed Norton in The Honeymooners, opposite Jackie Gleason. And he also originated the role of Felix Unger in the Broadway production of The Odd Couple. And it's kind of interesting because in that production, he actually suffered a kind of nervous breakdown while he was performing in The Odd Couple. This was due to his 25-year marriage ending. And he ended up leaving and staying in a sanitarium for 6 months. And what's more interesting about that is that he actually eventually remarried that first wife and stayed married to her until his death. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Co-starring as Mr. Dundee is John Fiedler. This is his first of two episodes of The Twilight Zone. The next we'll see of him is in season 3 in Cavender is Coming. He was also most known for his vocal work voicing Piglet in the Winnie the Pooh series. He was also juror number 2 in 12 Angry Men, and I really wish or hope or I don't know. I wish I could find an excuse to review 12 Angry Men on this podcast because it's just incredible. I love that movie. And rounding out the cast is Robert P. Lieb as Flaherty, Officer Flaherty. Flaherty. Sorry, this is the only Twilight Zone episode and only Rod Serling collaboration. He was in one episode of the short-lived sci-fi anthology series Out There back in 1951. That episode was titled Seven Temporary Moons, and I really struggled to find a plot description for that, but I did find one on TV.com that said, seven moon and star-like bodies appear near Earth and threatens its survival. So that's kind of interesting. I have this whole list of sci-fi anthology shows that I want to eventually get to and everything, and there are a few that are just unfindable. Like, I cannot find any episodes of Out There, or I can't find, like, a complete run of the episodes. A lot of them are lost in time. Same with, like, I think there are complete series sets of like Science Fiction Theater and One Step Beyond, but like I can't find anything of the One Step Beyond revival from I believe the 70s, Next Step Beyond, and I can't find any episodes of Out There, or the couple episodes of Journey to the Unknown I've reviewed have been just kind of off chances to find. So hopefully with time these shows get more available, but I mean I think that that's a very optimistic viewpoint to have, because I think that they're going to be lost in time, and that's really a shame, because it's a very interesting time capsule to go back and watch these shows. Not just The Twilight Zone, but just all the other anthology science fiction shows. Anyway, Robert P. Lieb also appeared in one episode of One Step Beyond. That episode was The Stonecutter, which is actually available in its entirety on YouTube, completely negating everything I just said. And it was actually, that episode was actually almost my bonus review for my episode of the podcast reviewing Nervous Man in a $4 Room. But I switched it kind of at the last minute for the inaugural episode of the 1985 Twilight Zone. Yeah, so maybe at some point I'll go back and review One Step Beyond's episode, The Stonecutter. And so writer for this episode was Rod Serling. And Serling got the idea after watching a Christmas parade with his kids, where the guy playing Santa was, and this is a quote that he said in TV Guide, the guy playing Santa was, quote, a last minute and third string replacement. So he just, that was where the episode was kind of born in his mind, was seeing this, very lackluster, portrayal of Santa in a Christmas parade. And he was ultimately, or at least immediately, disappointed with the episode. And he had said that because it was shot on videotape, it was, quote, an abomination and looks for all the world like a rough dress rehearsal that is a couple days from coming around. And I believe that later on, he kind of softened up to it, and he had a lot of pride toward the episode, especially because it became such a pivotal part of the series. I believe that that's true. But yeah, and I'll talk about this when I get into my review, but yeah, that whole videotape experiment, I'm so glad that there was only six episodes, because it does look kind of rough compared to the other episodes, and especially in this one, with the different sets and everything that they used. Director for this episode was Jack Smite. This is his third of four episodes, and the last we saw of his was The Lateness of the Hour just a couple weeks ago. And his next and final episode will be 22. And he actually also directed two Art Carney specials, which I think it's around the time that this episode, The Twilight Zone, aired, Art Carney had specials that featured him in either a comedic or a dramatic role, and they aired on NBC on a semi-monthly basis. And I think that there was maybe 10 specials in total. But anyway, Jack Smite directed two of them, so there's a little bit of a connection there. And so before I go into my feelings as a first-time viewer, just want to kind of briefly mention that what I knew before the episode, before watching the episode. And I did not know much. I just knew that it had something – it was a Christmas episode, and that it had something to do with Santa. And judging from the title of the episode, The Night of the Meek, it made me think of the, it's from the Bible, right? expression, the meek shall inherit the earth. It made me think of that. And that's really the only thing that I knew about this episode going in. So, without further ado, let me go into my feelings as a first time viewer of this episode of The Twilight Zone. And so right off the bat, I immediately noticed, yep, this is shot on tape, and it was pretty rough. The taped episodes in particular are really jarring in their opening shots, at least the two that I've seen, because it is such a stark difference from shooting on film, and it's something that you kind of – I feel like whenever these next four taped episodes come up – I feel like I'm going to have the same experience where I'm kind of like my brain is kind of adjusting to the drop in video quality. Yeah. And it's such a shame. Like I said, I'm so glad that it only lasts for six episodes. But despite that, the opening shot really, really, immediately puts you into the kind of Christmas spirit. I mean, you get a very, it's a relatively short shot that tells so much. Like, you have the department store shoppers bustling around. You have Santa's display that has the time on it. So that kind of seeds where the plot's going to go here in a minute. But while we have that, we also have jingle bells playing in the background. It just really puts you into the setting of the Christmas time in the spirit of Christmas. And then it immediately jerks you over to a bar where you see Santa drunk at the bar drinking and clearly intoxicated. And it immediately made me think, like, okay, this is maybe it's another down on his luck character that's going to have some fortune bestowed upon him. Unfortunately, that wasn't the case. It was actually a really interesting story. And one thing I want to mention is that the bartender said that Santa owes him for 6 drinks and a sandwich, and that's a total of $3.80. It's like, that's just amazing to me. I feel like between this, that comment about it only being $3.80 for 6 drinks and a sandwich, and last week when I mentioned how amazing that how amazing the camera would be and how much money the $9,500 is that they got, I feel like that's kind of like, you know, maybe giving you guys the impression that I'm broke. But hey, if you want to support, go and donate on PayPal or Patreon. But no, I'm doing quite okay, guys. Anyway, so we're introduced to Santa as he's kind of talking to the bartender. He wants more to drink. He doesn't have the funds for it, though. And I really like our first inclination, our first introduction to his whole thing about wanting to be Santa and the Christmas spirit itself, and kind of the theme of the episode is this static shot on his face as he's talking to the bartender, kind of slurring his speech and asking the bartender, asking him, why don't you think there's a Santa Claus? And I really liked this effect too. It's not even an effect. It's just an affectation on the performance of Art Carney, but it's a static shot, a static camera. And, Art Carney is just kind of waving his head around, but it's not over the top or anything. It's just a very clear and simple way to bring us into the fact that, yeah, as Percival Smithers says in a few scenes, Santa's loaded. So yeah. And then we're just brought into the, life of the story, from that. What we get is Art Carney in a very dramatic role. I mean, he's drunkenly lamenting the fact that Santa doesn't exist, and he's this kind of tortured person. And I wasn't familiar with Art Carney's work. I don't think I've really ever seen him in anything. But I always kind of associated the name Art Carney with being a strictly comedic actor. I may be wrong, but I've always associated that name with comedy. And his performance in this episode is just absolutely incredible, because he really brings home the drama that is his character in this episode of Henry Corwin. And as he leaves the bar, he kind of sees the kids. And what I noticed is, first of all, that the episode itself has a better just overall set design than Lateness of the Hour did, because Lateness of the Hour was very confined to two sets, really, because they just had like the foyer and the stairwell that was both in the same shot, and then they had the study. I think those are the only two sets that they had. So anyway, I was really relieved to see that this episode had more variety in their scenes. Like, they had the shelter, they had the bar, they had the department store, they had the streets, and then they also had the police station. Like, there's a lot of, and also the alleyway also. There is a lot of sets involved in this episode, and that was a big relief to me, being that this is the second episode that was taped on, that was videotaped, because I was just really relieved to see that them shooting on tape didn't affect the production value in terms of the set design and the sets, and the variety of the sets. Because I, after seeing Lateness of the Hour, I kind of expected that all of the videotaped episodes would be confined or kind of more bottle episodes that are all confined to single or a couple of similar indoor locations. So I was really pleased to see the variety in the sets. And so Santa or Henry, he finds two kids, and they kind of come up to him, and like the girl, like they go back and forth with what they want, and they're saying like all these like cute things and everything. Although the kid says, the kid asks for a gun, which I thought was funny. Obviously, it's a toy gun, but I just thought that it was just funny hearing that. But what's really heartbreaking and kind of brings home Henry's position in the episode is that the girl asks him to give her father a job, and like that's just so depressing and sweet and just kind of heartbreaking. And then the kid, the boy follows that up with, he follows it up by saying he wants a big turkey dinner for Christmas. And you get the impression that, you know, he's not expecting, like his family's struggling. And like that line, the big turkey dinner that he asked for, like I missed that, like probably up until the third time that I watched the episode, just because I was so just kind of affected by the little girl asking Santa to give her father a job for Christmas. So that just really kind of brought home the sadness that kind of swirls around Henry Corwin. And then that's when we get the Serling introduction and the narration, where he says that Henry Corwin is on his way to a strange kind of North Pole, which I thought was kind of cool. So he makes it back to the department store, and the manager of Mr. Dundee, John Fiedler, berates him for being late. And man, John Fiedler, he has the perfect voice for a scolding department store manager. And he's so great. I'll talk more about his character a little bit later when we get to the police station scene, but he is just kind of a sniveling, like he seems like he takes joy in berating Henry Corwin and scolding him and exercising his power over him. So I love that performance by John Fiedler. So Henry does his job, and first and only kid that comes up to him when he's at the store is this kid, Percival Smithers, which, first of all, he looks way too old to be visiting Santa. But he, like, just the way his face is kind of scrunched up, and he's just got this attitude as soon as he says his name, he just, like, immediately I'm like, oh my God, this kid's so annoying. And I kind of thought, like, okay, I kind of thought for a second it would be one of those things where it's like kid exposing Santa, that Santa's a fake and everything, but it went a different route with Henry just kind of blowing it, essentially. Like he reveals that he's drunk, and I like Percival Smithers, the character, I've never been so turned Percival Smithers, the character, I've never done such a 180 in terms of my feelings toward a character, because at first he seems so annoying, and then like I immediately thought, like, oh, I like this kid because he just says, look, Mom, Santa Claus is loaded. And I thought that was a really cool or a really funny line. And then the mother takes him, and then like she's just a kind of harping mother Like she says, I hope this isn't going to be a traumatic experience for you. And I thought that was a little on the nose, but she's kind of this over-the-top character that is to showcase how Henry feels about the world and how we view Christmas. And so at that point, Mr. Dundee fires Henry. And at that point, even though we've had the scene where he's lamenting that there's not a real Santa Claus and he's weeping with the children as they're asking him for things that they need for their family and they want. Even though that's been established and everything, I kind of still felt like when he got fired by Mr. Dundee, I kind of thought like, well, yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, he deserves it because he showed up drunk. He showed up late drunk and he kind of made he didn't do his job properly. And then again, like I just do a complete 180 because I immediately start sympathizing with the character because Art Carney delivers this monologue where he talks about how he apologizes for being drunk and he doesn't make any excuses for that. The reason that he drinks is that he's sad about the world and everything. And he says that he can either drink or he can weep over it and how the mother, he did nothing wrong toward the mother. She needs to learn that Christmas is about more than just going up and down aisles in a department store looking for material possessions and then he says that the world needs more just Christmas spirit and stuff. It's a very beautiful, beautiful monologue and very great. Like further establishing moment for the main arc of the episode, and it's great. And then he kind of has this meltdown in front of the store, like the whole store full of people, and again, it just kind of flips the sympathy for me toward him. Like there just wasn't much for us to sympathize with him up until that point when he's fired, until he gives this just impassioned monologue, and it's beautiful. And kind of that leads me into kind of what I love about the character of Henry Corwin is that he's not the way he is out of loneliness necessarily or due to any outside forces. Like he's not this struggling actor or like someone who's struggling to overcome some shortcoming or anything. He is like his sole drive throughout the entire episode and his sole focus and purpose is that he wants to be able to give people what they want. He wants to be Santa. And his dream is to just live in a world with a Santa. He has so much empathy for the people around him that he just wants to be able to give people what they want. And kind of to dig a little deeper in it, he seems very disillusioned with the world and this kind of faux spirit of or fake spirit of Christmas, that it's all consumerism and it's all turned into just this time of year where people are expecting things from others, and it's not about giving or about providing for other people or anything. It's not true to how it should be. Maybe that's reading into what's not there, but you can very easily extrapolate that from his speech and from his main arc throughout the episode. And so he's just this champion of the meek, as it were. His pain is just drawn from this empathy that he has for all the people he sees day in and day out who won't have a happy Christmas or a pleasant life at all. And it's the mark of just a really remarkable character and a very great, well-written character, well-rounded character written by Rod Serling. And Art Carney, man, he is just absolutely astounding in the role. I mean, it is just a beautiful, beautiful performance. And it's so fantastic. At the end of this season of Anthology, I'm going to be doing a top 10. And I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if this is definitely on that top 10. And I'll probably do like favorite moments, favorite performances. And Art Carney is definitely going to be mentioned on that episode. And so we have him leaving the department store after being fired, and then he's just kind of wandering around the street, and we get this, the first of a few, like, little moments where he hears the sleigh bells, and that that sound is played along with this very small hint of the first Noel. And like, the way that that comes and goes throughout the episode is just wonderful. Like, it is, it's such a, I wouldn't even say simple, because it's, I mean, it's just an effective, it's a very effective place, like, a very effective atmosphere building. But it's so, it's just beautiful. Like, whenever that comes in, that kind of, that, I mean, that's a great, it's a great implementation into the episode. And at that point, at this point in the episode, we're almost halfway through the episode, and I'm kind of wondering what's going to be the main, what's his experience in the Twilight Zone going to be? And I kind of wondered if that little girl that he saw was going to save him somehow, or I was wondering if the Twilight Zone was going to transform the neighborhood itself into a literal North Pole where people are creating gifts to ship out to people. But I wasn't quite right with that. But then he goes into this little alleyway, and then as a cat owner, I was a fan of the cat showing up and knocking over the bag of cans. It kind of had a kind of jump scare quality to it, which isn't a criticism. I thought that was kind of neat. And that's when the bag of cans transforms into presence. And that's when it just clicked with me that, oh, this is the Santa Claus. Which obviously, like, I'm aware that this came before the movie The Santa Claus with Tim Allen, but that's my frame of reference for it. And that's when he runs through the streets with in the Santa costume with the bag, yelling Merry Christmas, everybody, and basically this is his triumphant moment. And one of this episode's biggest strengths is that it takes half of its runtime to put Harry in this position. It's 12 minutes into the episode, and that's when we get the bag with the presents and Henry yelling Merry Christmas, everybody. It's the big triumphant. It's Henry Corwin's version of Jimmy Stewart running through the town at the end of It's a Wonderful Life. And it's so wonderful because we are only halfway through the episode, and we have in this first half a self-contained story arc for the main character. And it's so well done that, I mean, the episode itself could have ended right there, and we still would have had a very strong episode with a very good arc for our main character, but we still have 13 minutes to go. And it's just remarkable the level of storytelling that went into the first half of this episode. And it went toward paying off really well. So we come back from the commercial break, and Henry has the bag, and it just reminds me a lot, or reminded me quite a bit of What You Need, but kind of tainted a little bit. Like, What You Need, it was all mystery, and Henry in this case is just, he's just as in the dark as the recipients of the gifts. So he doesn't have that moment where he's just like he can't see the future or anything like that. And what I just love about the character is that he couldn't care less about what's going on. This isn't a mystery about what's going on with the presents. He is just like his sole purpose is to spread joy and cheer, and he's going to do it because it makes him happy. He doesn't care what, why, or what's going on. And like, that's the embodiment of just a great, strong character that's, you can really latch onto. In an episode this is a very like feel good episode of the Twilight Zone, and I love it for it. I love this episode for that purpose and for that reason. And so he goes to the shelter and he is giving presents to everyone. And, man, when you didn't think that you're I didn't think that I could love the character more or I could love the story more. until Henry just, like, he slowly gives the old man a cane. And, like, just the gentle way that he does it, it's a very kind of subtle, like, it's not anything that's needed. But, like, just the kind of, just the care that he gives to the old man as he hands them the cane is just really, really beautiful. And at that point, I'm just like, Henry's turn into a completely delightful Santa without even sobering up is just a really great kind of transformation. It shows a very wide range of acting ability for Art Carney in this episode. And I mean, it's just, there are episodes of The Twilight Zone where you get really drawn into the story and you're just kind of just pulled along for the ride. And this is one of those episodes for me because I was just so engrossed in this performance and the setting and the story that I was hooked on this episode. I loved it. And then we have Officer Flaherty coming in and kind of causing the big injecting the episode with drama, because obviously we need that, because, you know, he can't just go around giving presents to people. I kind of thought that it was a little, not weak, but I didn't live in the 1960s or anything, so I don't know what the police culture was like, but I kind of felt like the officer's assumption that the contents of the bag were stolen was just a little, I don't know, it's a little weak. I mean, granted, yeah, it makes sense. It tracks logically, but I kind of found myself thinking, like, does he really have enough grounds to detain him and the bag? But I mean, it didn't detract from the episode or anything. And the fact that he just assumed that it was just stolen from the department store, again, it tracks logically, it makes sense, and it brings Mr. Dundee back into the episode. And that's where you get the real, they double down on Mr. Dundee being a complete a-hole. And I really liked that because, A, I really, really liked John Fiedler's performance as Mr. Dundee. I thought that he was great. And like, it was a delight to see him just go off on Henry and scold him more and be just have that energy in another scene. But the thing that I kind of really started to notice after a couple of viewings is that the juxtaposition of Henry and Mr. Dundee, it's really an interesting dichotomy that they strike in this episode, because Henry's sole purpose is providing people with gifts and happiness and cheer and everything, while Mr. Dundee, on the other hand, he almost gets enjoyment, pure enjoyment, out of berating Henry and even berating the police officer. And it's just an interesting kind of dichotomy to the episode that I thought was played really well. And I like the idea that the gifts were not necessarily the idea that the gifts were coming from the store, but I kind of thought at that moment, like, what if the gifts were, like, what if, like, the Twilight Zone was just taking the gifts from the store and putting them in the bag? And I thought that would have been an interesting wrinkle, but probably not enough runtime to really play with that. But I like the way that it kind of plays with Dundee, like when he goes into the bag to try to get it and it reverts back to cans and the cat makes an appearance again. I love that. And then at a moment where the episode has its probably one of its most, like, one of its more dramatic but still kind of playful moments, because you think, well, Henry's in trouble now and I don't know how he's going to get out of it. Dundee challenges him and the bag for a bottle of brandy. And this was probably my favorite part of the episode, is that in that moment, Dundee says a very specific type of drink and specific year and everything. And then Henry, just like Art Carney's performance, just snaps. It turns on a dime and he just like, his face lights up and he's like, ooh, that's a good year. Like, I love that. Like, that was a purely, like, a beautiful comedic moment. I really loved that scene. And then at that point, that's when I started to wonder what Henry's going to get out of the bag and if he would get anything. And as fate would have it, Bert, the character of Bert, sat down, and we had that moment where Bert is asking him what he wants out of the bag and what is he going to get out of it. And this is where just like, I mean, this is just, it's beautiful because Henry doesn't want anything other than to be, as he puts it, the biggest gift giver of all time. And that's just a really heartwarming sentiment because he is a person who has witnessed just, you know, people that are struggling so hard in his neighborhood. And that's just the only thing that he wants is to give people something to make them happy. And that's fantastic. That's just really heartwarming, a really heartwarming sentiment. And then he follows it up with saying that if he could get anything, then he wishes that he could do that every year. And that just seals Henry Corwin as just one of the most likable characters in the Twilight Zone thus far. Like, he is just a delightful character, and I just love him and his performance. And then we get kind of the end run of the episode is that his gift from the bag is the sleigh, and he is Santa Claus now. And I just, that's such a great, like, that's such a great Christmas story, like Christmas time story. Like, he just becomes Santa. And then we have a recursion of the first Noel music in the sleigh bells ringing when he finds a sleigh. And it's the perfect ending to this episode and this character. And, and then we follow that up with the actual final scene of the episode with Mr. Dundee and Officer Flaherty leaving the police station. And that's a great, like, kind of button on the episode because, Mr. Dundee is turned from being a Grinch to just being a very, very likable person. And Flaherty, who also gave Henry a hard time, he's lightened up a lot too. And it's a great way to end the episode. And, that, like, we see Flaherty look up and sees Corwin and they make plans to spend their holiday together and it's just a wonderful sentiment and a wonderful episode overall. So overall, man, I loved The Night of the Meek. It's such a great Christmas themed episode. And honestly, watching this episode is going to become a yearly tradition for me. Like, I am someone who I love Christmas movies and Christmas stories and everything. We did, Christmas themed episodes for, on the Obsessive Viewer years and years ago. But yeah, I'm just a sucker for any kind of Christmas, story. And the Twilight Zone's The Night of the Meek is absolutely going to make it into my yearly rotation of Christmas things. Like, I'm holding it to about as high an esteem as I can with the Christmas movies and Christmas stories and stuff. Like, it's entering the yearly rotation of Charlie Brown Christmas and It's a Wonderful Life and the Santa Claus. just movies and shows that I watch on a yearly basis. Anyway, so I'm excited to revisit it next year, or the next couple weeks too. So trivia for this episode, I only have a couple things aside from what I've already mentioned in the talent rundown. According to the Twilight Zone Companion, one viewer was so offended at the episode's depiction of a drunk Santa that he wrote letters to Serling, not only to Serling, but to Serling, the network, and to several newspapers, just voicing his offense at the depiction of a drunk Santa, which makes me kind of wonder if what that person would think if they ever saw the movie Bad Santa. And then also, according to Unlocking the Door to a Television Classic, Serling also received a letter from a woman who was offended by the portrayal of Sister Florence. Now, Sister Florence is a character that I didn't really talk about in my review, but I did notice she was very, just kind of off the bat. She was a very stern, very, angry person who, I can see why that complaint was brought in, but, But yeah, she's not as substantial a character as enough to really derail the episode or anything like that. So that does it for my review of The Night of the Meek. And before we go on to my bonus review for this week, I'm going to play a highlight from a recent episode of The Obsessive Viewer, which is a weekly movie and TV podcast that I host over at obsessiveviewer.com with my friend Tiny, and kind of a rotating panel of guests, or occasionally our friends come on and talk to us about movies and stuff. So here's a clip from a recent episode, and enjoy. Like, Rogue One was really good for me because it was a war movie about this rebellion and everything, and elements of A New Hope and Empire also have that, but for the most part it's just I wanted it to be more of a focal point. So in Battlefront 2, it is a focal point. You feel that. You definitely feel it. And it's really cool. Of course, you can find The Obsessive Viewer on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and at obsessiveviewer.com. And you can find more of my podcasting, including my other podcast, Tower Junkies, over at obsessiveviewer.com/podcasts. And so for my bonus review for this episode, usually I don't do spoilers or anything, but since this is the Twilight Zone, it's a review of Night of the Meek, which is the 1985 remake of The Night of the Meek. And this episode aired December 20th, 1985, and a couple changes for this bonus review. Usually when I review episodes from 1985 or 1980s Twilight Zone, I also review the other stories that aired with that episode or with that story. But I think that since eventually I may cover the 80s Twilight Zone, I'm just going to do just the ones that were remade. So I'm only going to be reviewing Night of the Meek in this episode, not the other two stories that were aired alongside it on December 20th, 1985. Those other stories were titled But Can She Type? And The Star. So I'm also, since this is based on the teleplay by Rod Serling, and it is pretty close to it, there are some deviations and everything, but since for the most part it does follow those same story beats, I'm going to go ahead and just kind of spoil this iteration of Night of the Meek in my bonus review. So if you don't want to be spoiled about the remake, feel free to you know, not listen to this review, but just wanted to give you a heads up ahead of time. So, this iteration was pretty good. It was all right. It was a really, again, kind of like the original, but not as great. It is a really good job of kind of bringing you into the Christmas spirit and the Christmas time of year. And, the character playing Mr. Dundee, or the actor playing Mr. Dundee, is the incomparable William Atherton from Die Hard and Ghostbusters. He's such a great 80s villain. And in the kind of one change to this is that there was another employee in the department store covering for Santa. And I thought that was a nice touch. Like, you see a scene where the other employee is kind of moving the clock back so that Henry isn't as late as you would expect. And then it follows the kind of same trajectory as the original episode. You get the bar scene. And right off the bat, I mean, Richard Mulligan plays Henry Corwin. And he's no Art Carney. I mean, I'm sorry to say that. Like, it's not anything too bad or anything, but I didn't get that kind of dramatic kind of feel to it. I didn't have that empathy in that character. And there are some changes. His first kind of experience with the power of the bag and everything is that money kind of appears in his pocket. And I mean, it gives the episode a little bit of a mystery to it that I don't think it really needed. But it redeems that mystery and that kind of, it redeems that feeling that I had by showing Corwin giving the money to kids outside the bar. I thought that was kind of a nice touch. And another thing that I'm kind of back and forth about is that instead of kind of this, kind of smaller, like neighborhood kind of feel to it, it kind of gives like the set of the department store and everything kind of gives this more like this bigger city feel. And maybe that's just, I don't know. It just kind of felt like that loses some of the beauty of the original episode, which maybe they were going for a big city feel in the original episode, but since it was just a backlot, it wasn't as prominent. But it's pretty prominent here, and it kind of felt like it was, I didn't really know how I felt about it. But then it kind of, again, it kind of redeemed itself at that point because, Henry, his big moment where he is lamenting the plight of the meek and everything is that, like, his point is that the kids in the store themselves aren't going to be disappointed by Christmas because they're going to get what they want, but kids in the poorer neighborhoods will be disappointed and won't get what they want. And I thought that was a nice touch. That was a nice kind of that was a nice element to bring into the story. And I thought that was good. So the actual bag is actually a garbage bag, which I thought was pretty funny. Like it's actual, like an actual, like plastic garbage bag, like a hefty bag. So I thought that was interesting because the one in the original was kind of felt like just a sack. But this is just like, it's a legitimate like garbage bag. Yeah. And then there are carolers that at least they sing for Henry outside of his apartment. And I thought that was a nice touch that kind of brought us more into the holiday spirit and everything. And it was really, at that point, the episode was really selling the Christmas feel really well. But it's not as great as that musical cue in the original of the first Noel, in the sleigh bells. The sleigh bells are still in this episode, but missing that first Noel cue is just, it didn't, like, I give the episode credit for not trying to imitate that, but it also just, any use of music in this episode isn't as great as the first Noel in the original. So it's another big kind of deviation from it is that instead of showing Henry giving people presents and everything, our kind of introduction to it is seeing like Dundee driving through the street and seeing just tons of extras or tons of people, I should say, happy and filled with happiness because they have all of these presents and gifts and everything. And they're just super happy. And I kind of felt like that was kind of to the detriment of the episode because we don't see enough of Henry being delighted and giving his, giving the presents and everything. We get some of that when Dundee goes into the building. I think it was back in the store. I don't remember, but when he goes into the building and he sees Corwin giving the gifts, like we get some of that. But at that point, the focus of it is more shifted to Dundee's perspective rather than having Henry be the focal point of that and Henry's happiness because we just saw him as a drunken, upset person. And then now we're getting his perspective, a perspective of him giving presents and being happy, but it's through the lens of a person who kind of hates him and it's more his reaction is more the focal point of it rather than Henry's kind of transformation in the episode. And I think that was much to the detriment of the episode for me. And I did notice a couple things about the gifts and everything is that an adult asks for, she says, what I can really use is a new alarm clock so I wake up on time for work, which, like, I put in my notes, I put that quote, and then I put, adults, because, and that's kind of, maybe that's saying something, that adults are just looking for something that they need or something that improves their life and everything, and they're not in touch with their childlike, like, there's not a possession that they want that's just for them, but this is a tool to help her prepare for her time at work that she spends a considerable amount of her life at, but is not a place that is a source of fun. Or who knows, maybe she works at an amusement park. I don't know. And then also a kid got a baseball glove, which is kind of a not necessarily callback, but nice reference to the original episode. But he does mention that he's like, oh, and it's left-handed too. And I respected that because I'm a lefty. So then at this point, I was kind of wondering if they were going to forego the whole police subplot and everything. But they don't. Fortunately, Mr. Dundee has a Zach Morris phone from Saved by the Bell, and he calls the police. And what I did like this, that the police presence in the episode is a little easier to swallow, just because he asks if they have, if Corwin has receipts, and he says, well, no. And then he's like, well, we don't know where they came from. We'll need to, it goes through the extra effort to show that he has more, he has a firmer, probable cause to confiscate it. He doesn't take him into custody or anything. He just says, well, we need to, make sure we've got all of them and until we can figure out what's going on. So it was a lot easier for me to swallow that subplot in this iteration of it. And then they got a really cool, scene, and I thought this was really clever of them to incorporate into the episode, but then instead of detaining him and doing the whole thing there, the bag itself produces receipts, and I thought that was really a clever wrinkle to bring into it, and a good way to kind of explain that a good way to basically bring us into the final kind of act. And there was an earlier scene where Mr. Dundee had a custom-made dress or coat that was missing or given away, or sold, I should say, when it was supposed to be on hold. So of course that's what the bag produces for him, and that's nice and everything. And then it produces a signed baseball for him, and I kind of really like that the end of the episode, this iterations version of the Bert and Henry scene on the steps where Henry says that what he wants is just to be the best gift giver ever. This iteration is between him and Dundee, which I really appreciated because they have more, like I said in my review of the original, they have that dichotomy where they're kind of at odds and they're kind of different ends of the spectrum there. And also the dialogue was pretty strong. Dundee asks him what his gift was, and Henry just says, "This night was my gift." And I just like that it was Dundee who asks him what he wants out of it. And instead of finding a sleigh and then flying off, his beard actually becomes real. And I thought that was a nice touch, an actual transformation. And then they went two steps too far by having him go through a chimney. He's in his apartment and then he goes through his chimney. There's some, for the time, it was pretty okay special effects, but he just basically evaporates into a bunch of lights and then flies into the chimney and up through it. And I felt that was kind of weird. I kind of felt maybe they didn't have the budget to spring for a sleigh. Cause it didn't really make sense. The concept is that Santa comes down the chimney. I mean, I guess, he goes back up the chimney when he gives the presents and everything, but it's just kind of weird because, you would think that would be him going down a chimney, but that's neither here nor there. Anyway, I thought that was kind of weird. And then it ends with Mr. Dundee seeing him fly. And I kind of like that ending, that sentiment, because like I said, it kind of brings home the opposing sides of Dundee and Henry in the episode. And then it just kind of ends kind of suddenly because, this aired with two other stories. So obviously they didn't have and also the 80s Twilight Zone didn't have, opening narration or closing narration or anything like that. So just kind of ends. And I thought it was pretty good. It was pretty good. I still obviously love the original. I don't know if I'll watch the remake that much, or I won't have that on a rotation each year for my Christmas viewing watching, Christmas story watching and stuff, but we'll see. So, yeah, that'll do it for this episode of Anthology. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you like what you've heard and you want to support the show, the easiest way to do that is by leaving a rating and review on iTunes. And you can also donate to the show through PayPal by clicking the donate button on anthologypod.com or by becoming a recurring patron like Robert, who I referenced last episode. My weeks are all messed up. was it last week? No, it wasn't. It was 2 weeks ago. Man, it's 1 a.m. Or no, it's 12:30, so I need to go to bed. I have work tomorrow. Anyway, you can become a recurring donor at Patreon at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. Join Robert and become a recurring patron. So next week on the show, I am going to be reviewing Dust, which is episode 12 of the Twilight Zone second season. And then the bonus review is still kind of up in the air. At that point, I'm not sure what I'm going to review as a bonus review, but I believe that I haven't watched the episode of Dust yet, but I believe that Douglas Hayes is the director of it. So maybe I'll just pull something from his filmography, or maybe I'll just throw a I'll review something of Serling's because he wrote the episode, and I kind of want to get more into his filmography as I go through the Twilight Zone. So I don't want to necessarily have to match up his work with it, but it'll probably be a standalone Serling story that I review next week, but we'll find out. Thank you guys so much for listening. Once again, follow me at OV Anthology Pod. I just realized that I need to update the outro for this, because I think in the outro I say obsessive viewer. But anyway, thank you guys so much for listening, and Merry Christmas, and have a happy, safe Christmas and everything. And yeah, I'll see you next time.
A word to the wise to all the children of the 20th century, whether their concern be pediatrics or geriatrics, whether they crawl on hands and knees and wear diapers, or walk with a cane and comb their beards. There's a wondrous magic to Christmas, and there's a special power reserved for little people. In short, there's nothing mightier than the meek. And a Merry Christmas to each and all.
Thank you for listening to Anthology, presented by ObsessiveViewer.com. For more of Anthology and a full archive of my episodes, go to anthologypod.com. And if you want to help support the show, the easiest way you can do that is by leaving a rating and a review on iTunes. You can also make donations to the show courtesy of the donate link in the show notes of each episode and on anthologypod.com. For recurring donations, you can become a patron at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer and just choose one of the Anthology reward tiers. If you enjoy Anthology, feel free to check out The Obsessive Viewer, a weekly movie and TV podcast I host with my friend Tiny and occasional guest co-hosts over at ObsessiveViewer.com. You can also join The Obsessive Viewer Facebook group at Facebook.com/TheObsessiveViewer. For book reviews and commentary on the world of reading, check out our sister site at ObsessiveBookNerd.com. And for philosophical discussions from a secular viewpoint, check out my friends Chad and Amanda at TheSecularPerspective.com. Finally, if you'd like to contact me with your thoughts on the show, my reviews, my bonus reviews, or for any other reason, you can tweet me at ObsessiveViewer, send me an email at Matt@ObsessiveViewer.com, or send me a message on Facebook and like the Facebook page at Facebook.com/AnthologyPod. Once again, thank you guys so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.
This is your moment. Your moment to move forward and make progress. It's time to see where an education can take you. For over 130 years, Strayer University has been at the forefront of change, offering programs that help students like you get ahead and stay ahead, so you can keep striving. Visit strayer.edu to learn more. Strayer University is certified to operate in Virginia by CHEV.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.